Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Well, very recently, it was made official, if it hadn't been before, Rabbit Angstrom is officially a novel. It's a novel published in the last 25 years, and it is considered by people sent ballots by the New York Times to be one of the five most important novels published in America in the last 25 years. So I thought it would be wonderful, instructive, fascinating to read it as a whole and to accept it as John Updike, its author, suggests that it is a mega novel. And I don't think many people have had the opportunity to talk to John Updike about the work as a whole, and I thought it would be wonderful, since I have him in the studio, and a great honor to talk to him about it that way. Now, first of all, there has been, since the completion of the four novels, a novella that appeared in Licks of Love. Is Rabbit and his saga now over? Because I expect another 4 years from now to hear more.
I can't imagine any device or frame in which I would perpetrate a further sequel. The whole book, the whole mega novel, let's call it, was improvised in a way. I think of all the writing I've done, the writing of these four and a half, let's call them novels, was most trance-like, most fluid, most open to accident. Contemporary news events would just sneak their way in the very next day if the page, there's a spot on the page, so they are the most casual and yet probably the most, may I say, majestic of my novelistic efforts. I wrote Rabbit Run with no thought of a sequel. I was prodded to write a sequel, Rabbit Redux, because I couldn't think of anything other to do. I turned back to Rabbit because people had asked me, well, what happened to him? The ending is deliberately open-ended, ending of Rabbit Run. And so I wrote, with some gathering excitement, to Rabbit Redux about his adult, about his life 10 years later as a typographer for a small city newspaper and further adventures of his marriage and of his son, Nelson, who now is 12. One sequel sort of demands another, and 10 years later I wrote Rabbit is Rich, and 10 years later still wrote Rabbit at Rest. I thought he should be put to rest because I was in danger of going to the well too often. I didn't want to write about him when I was senile or even beginning to show signs of senility. So I killed him off before that could happen. 10 years after that, I did think I would be seemly to tie up the loose ends of the parentage of his illegitimate daughter and have her meet her brother, Nelson. And they do, and that was fun to be back in that world. Really a pleasure, and as always, things seem to happen and move along smoothly without much forced invention on my part. But, you know, what would be left, only maybe somehow entering into Annabelle in the year 2009. And I hesitate to do that. Not 100% sure I'll be alive in the year 2009, and even if I am, my opinion now is no, I will not. I will not try the patience of the people who have been so loyal to Rabbit and to me through him. I will not try their patience by writing yet another sequel.
Now, in the fourth book, Rabbit at Rest, you mentioned that you had many themes to converge and send off. And a book written out of improvisations that is susceptible to all of the immediacy of the present tense, it's difficult to give it the aesthetic illusion of being completed. And I wondered, what were those themes you felt responsible to have converge in that final novel?
The theme of the drowned child, the infant who was drowned in Rabbit Run, haunts the sequence. And he kind of, as I remember, you're talking about a mega novel that you've reread recently and I haven't reread for quite a while. But at any rate, the spell of that, the sin of that was somewhat lifted when he did manage, though he was himself suffering from a heart attack, when he did manage to save his granddaughter out there sunfishing, thank you, sunfishing in the Gulf of Mexico. The themes that converge, I don't know, what are the themes of this mega novel? Basketball is one, youthful athletic, the joy of running, and by extension the joy of being alive, the quality of the marriage, which is on view from very early pages to the last, Janice's own strengthening while he diminishes more and more. Society has less and less use for him in a way, and his later prosperity is based really upon the happy accident of marrying a car dealer's daughter. And as the car dealing prospered, so did the son-in-law, but it's nothing that he achieved. Theme of parenting, surely. Rabbit at Rest ends with him trying from his deathbed to assure his child, his son, with whom he has such a conflicted and in a way constantly aborted relationship, but whom nevertheless is very much on his mind, always tries to reassure the boy that dying isn't so bad, it's not so bad. And what other themes? Sex is certainly a theme. The wish to adventure. Somewhere I talk about exploring women's bodies. I mean, each sexual encounter, in a sense, enriches his knowledge, but also in a way depletes it. There's less and less to learn. There's less and less to experience. So maybe he rounds out his sexual inventory by sleeping with his son's wife. And what else I can't imagine. In a way, the book is also about the region in which it takes place, my native region of Pennsylvania, a region I left to go to college and never really returned to, but which has remained essentially live, or where I feel at home, where I think I know how things happen. There must be some other themes too, but those are it. It's about family, and the course of mortality, the diminishment of powers, the inadequacy, when all is said and done, of our best efforts, and the fact that we deal with the children that we bring into the world, are responsible for them somehow.
You know, what fascinated me was to realize that we never have known Rabbit in his glory days. The book begins in his, that state of being an ex-athlete, an ex-high school athlete. And although we hear from time to time from Marty Tuthertoe about Tuthero, is it? About Rabbit's heroism, we don't hear that much, you know. Rabbit has it in his head. Other people, even in the first book, are kind of tired of his replay of these exploits. So in a peculiar way, it's a novel that doesn't begin and that begins instead with a 20 or 30 page climax. He goes driving and driving, and decides during those 30 pages that being Jack Kerouac won't do, and he goes home. And there, in a sense, the novel begins with the recognition that you can be against the life around you and still a part of it, which seems to me to be a signal recognition in American literature. Most of the people we know from the great American books light out and light out for good. He comes home having had a single night's adventure. It's as if it's his Nighttown episode in the very first chapter of the book. And the rest of the series is about what do you do when your face is shoved in dailiness, for better and worse, and although you may despise it, you are caught in it for the rest of your life and responsible to it. What a job.
That's very well said, and I couldn't have possibly said that as well myself. But yes, he decides that on the road is not for him, though he does in a later novel actually manage to. His dream is, I think, his sense of escape. That first impulse is that he's going to get to Florida, someplace where it's warm and the sun always shines. Florida is, for many people, a kind of a goal to be reached, and he does finally reach it. In Rabbit is Rich when he achieves the Florida condo and drives. You see him driving south all the way, but by that time, of course, it isn't the refutation of society or social expectations that the first trip would have been. It's just what everybody else does, too. He's become, as you say, he's become an average, not an average, but an ordinary American, trying to face up to his responsibilities without quite surrendering his inner sense of his inner needs and his inner imperatives and his inner sense that he's somehow very special.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Updike about Rabbit Angstrom, which is the mega novel composed of the four Rabbit novels, Rabbit Run, Rabbit Redux, Rabbit Is Rich, and Rabbit at Rest, published by, it's not Knopf, it's Everyman's Library. All of them together in one volume and chosen as one of the five best books published in the last 25 years in America, although in point of fact it's really over a 40-year period of publication. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Updike about Rabbit Angstrom. Now, just as Rabbit is haunted by the events of his past, it seems to me when I read Updike that there is a haunting event. I've imagined it. It's the day that a young man who lives in a farming community receives a letter in a mailbox saying that he's been accepted to Harvard. And it seems to me that that extraordinary event is one of the American miracles, that a boy from a family of no social connection, of no fame, receives such a letter, and that it warms the heart of the fiction that follows, which nevertheless is all about different forms of disappointment, that in the face of a human miracle, there are still the daily disappointments that don't make the miraculous impossible, but make the miraculous more miraculous in a certain sense.
Now, fiction, by its very nature, has to be the bringer mostly of bad news, since good news doesn't. Good news has no events in it. It's just a sort of state of bliss. Yes, it's nirvana. So it's not surprising that I deal with disappointment and conflict and failure. Also, I did grow up in the aroma of failure. My grandfather, a man of some prosperity and great dignity and a beautiful speaker. He was a Pennsylvania Dutch, but he spoke English with a real flourish. Should have been a politician, my father always maintained. But anyway, he lost his money. My father lost his job. My mother, a very intelligent woman, very intelligent. She really came out of the sticks growing up on a farm, the only child, the only animals and birds and their songs to keep her company. So, yes, I grew up with this sense of disappointment around me and the four adults I grew up with, which maybe gave me a prematurely adult sense of reality. I was very lucky, of course, to be admitted to Harvard. I did well on the SATs or whatever the equivalent was at that time. I took tests nicely, and I think they had to look beyond the Massachusetts prep schools to bring in a few other students for the sake of, they didn't call it that, diversity. So I was a piece of diversity as a Pennsylvania boy instead of I was turned down by Princeton, I'll point out, and the same probably again because they had plenty of Eastern Pennsylvania boys already. But Harvard was just right for me, and because it was kind of loose. It wasn't as preppy or as, I don't know, as it was. It accepted unconventional people and did have the Harvard Lampoon on it, and that was really taught me as much as any course I took there was working for the Lampoon. It was a happy day. Another happy day also occurred at that same mailbox. You know, I forget the moment that I was admitted to Harvard, but I remember well the moment when I went out to that mailbox there in the summer, already married, and took out an envelope that was from the New Yorker, but an unexpectedly small size, and it said in that small size that I had a story accepted. So I was 22, freshly married, and thought, well, gee, now I've made it, and I'm now a professional writer. It was a great moment.
Now, as soon as we meet Janice in Rabbit Run, we're aware that nothing is going to go very well with this marriage, and it's awful, or at least the perceptions of awfulness within the characters mark the marriage as being a battleground. So Rabbit comes home, and you know, it's such a amazing and startling thing. There's no attempt to chart a fall here. This is a fallen world. It's a fallen marriage. And the four books, although they grow progressively in a strange way merry, it's almost the merriment of resignation. This has become very funny once you accept how ludicrous it's going to get. You know, it's almost a form of slap happiness that that Rabbit is made to experience. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, for all of the luminous moments, the procedure of a life that really has to be, you know, the reader, this reader, experiences it with the grinding of teeth. Oh, no. Oh, pity him. Oh, give him something a little bit better to live for. You know, it's really the American disappointment scene, the anti-American dream that this book manages to charter, the mega book.
Yes, I hope I haven't been too punishing of Harry as his creator. I've presided over his life within these intervals of 10 years each. I hope with not too much sadism, but I do see him as a short-term winner and kind of a long-term loser, but who finds even in losing a certain pleasure and certain moments of bliss. Janice, whom you first see in a very dismal light. In fact, comes to enjoy her triumphs in Rabbit Redux. She has an affair. She falls in love outside the marriage. And in Rabbit is Rich, her accident of birth bestows upon the couple Toyota agency, which prospers in the fuel crunch. So he becomes, in relative terms, rich and prosperous. And she even strikes out then and gets a job in the last. So she grows. She grows and develops strengths and attractions. They have a sex life, which isn't always bad. In fact, in Rabbit is Rich, it's rather good at moments. Yes, well, it goes with the resignation to the daily, to the ordinary that you remarked upon earlier. I mean, she is part of ordinary existence, in that you have a wife like this. He does covet other women. He sleeps with some, covets more, but nevertheless, you have a wife and you make the best of it.
But in some way, I think that you will have to admit your American sadness is more profound than your American prosperity.
You've read the books more recently than I, and undoubtedly they are meant to express the sadness of aging, more keen for an athlete than for a would-be intellectual. But yes, in the sense of loss that every day lived, every moment of sunshine you outlive is lost. And there is a certain sadness, perhaps, to American life, in that we expect so much of it. We are Puritans to a degree, in that we're waiting for the visitations of grace, and they don't come often enough or unambiguously enough to satisfy us.
Well, there's a moment in Rabbit at Rest. Rabbit is visiting the neighborhood that he lived for 2 months, approximately, with Ruth, the woman with whom he was having an affair. They've replaced the trees. We later learn Bartlett pear trees, which are not going to bear fruit, but they have come into blossom, and the dust from them is all over the ground. And Rabbit thinks to himself, and he convinces us in his thought, these people underneath these trees are in paradise. But what does he mean?
It's really based upon actuality, autobiography. I was in Reading, city of Reading, where in whose suburb of Fillington I lived for my first 18 years, what can I say about it? It's a kind of a tawdry, rundown place where I never lived myself, but which has always seemed the city to me. And so to write a novel with Rabbit as the hero that takes place in part in the city was for me a leap, much as writing about a terrorist was a leap. I'm not...
You're Rabbit. Always leaping.
Yeah, a little leap. You try to leap to give yourself a jolt, and you try to reach. You try to reach to because across a gap, because if you just write about yourself, it'll come out sort of soggy and boring like any long personal anecdote. But there I was in Reading, the real city behind Brewer. I think my mother was in one of her hospital spells. I turned a corner up around 8th Street, and the Bartlett pear trees, as you say, had been planted, and we're all in blossom. So I entered into this tunnel of white, and the ground was covered with white petals, and everything was white, and I couldn't believe it. And here were a mother and child and a couple people out on the stoop chatting, unaware that they were living in a kind of heaven. But I could see this was heaven that had been achieved. And I put it in my novel, maybe without a sufficient context. But that was a moment of surprise in seeing the dear old, dirty, tired Reading nevertheless had a street full of heavenly glory.
But that kind of moment, like the basketball going in the rim, does seem to punctuate these books sometimes almost as a tease, that there is a transcendent beauty and grace, a moment of perfection. It seems, you know, that these are the kinds of things Nabokov talked about aesthetically, and as the creator of them, Nabokov felt considerable pleasure. But within a life, are those moments where the trees seem perfect adequate to our sense of, at least if it's reached the point of disgust that Rabbit feels, does the transcendence matter?
I loved that in Nabokov, though, that willingness to admit bliss, and indeed to call his books, one novel is called Glory, and there's always that sense of terrific pleasure. He was an intellectual, really one of the brightest men probably who ever wrote fiction, and the sense that a chess puzzle or that nature itself was full of these impostures, the way a grasshopper looks like a leaf, all that turned him on to a high degree, because he didn't have my American sadness, if that's what I have. Enough is, well, what is enough, really? What would measure up? Suppose Rabbit were as convinced of God's presence as Ahmad is. Would that be enough? I think normal human unhappiness must be taken as happiness.
I've been speaking with John Updike on the occasion of the selection of the four Rabbit novels under the title Rabbit Angstrom and published by Everyman's Books, the selection of this as one of the five books of the American quarter century. Thank you, John, for joining me. It's been a pleasure. A
pleasure to be on the air with such a good reader as yourself.
Thank you. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books, 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 books. Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.